Now, do you live down here now?
I
guess you do.
I do.
And were you living in L.A. at the time?
Yes, sir.
Met?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, I mean, we can either add that into the mix.
Oh, absolutely, man. We're going to keep this very...
I can bring a bigger table over.
No, we're good, brother. Don't worry. It's not a problem. I'm in Austin, Texas.
Okay.
With Mitch Marine.
All right. Yeah, you are.
You thought I was just making an announcement.
Yeah.
Well, you did just ask me if I'm living here now.
Yeah, because last time we met in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And it had to be well over 10 years ago.
Well, the show started in 2012. And I think I checked into it. You were episode 38. So I believe that would have been 2012.
Right, yeah. So, okay, 10 years ago.
10 years ago. Do you remember where we met?
It was it wasn't the Fox and Hound. It was the Fox. Was it the Fox and Hound?
Cat and Fiddle.
Fox and Hound is on Ventura Boulevard.
Yeah.
Cat and Fiddle is on Sunset or Hollywood?
It's now on Highland. They moved it.
Since COVID?
No, I think it was pre-COVID, I want to say.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, this is 10 years ago, so...
We met at the Cat and Fiddle I remember.
Yes. And it was early in the game as a podcast for me, and it was loud. I think we were eating.
And drinking.
And drinking, and it was just everything wrong.
Except for we had fun.
Oh, we had a good time, and I was told you on the phone, I remember the cockroach crawling up the wall, and it was like, oh, good times. Cool. But I think we got comped something, I want to say. We mentioned it to the waitress.
Hmm.
I feel like that happened.
That sounds something like I would try.
Yeah. I think both of us would try something like that. Anyway, it's been 10 years, man.
Yeah.
And you still got the same gig. I mean, you've been on this gig for 20 years, is my right?
Almost 19.
19 years.
Since 2003.
Dwight Yoakam.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
I think in the world of... It's interesting, having spent this much time on the gig and having friends that their profession is jumping from gig to gig. They, with a gig for a couple of years, because that gig is touring, and then that gig is not touring, and they go off and do the next tour and stuff like that. There aren't very many gigs like mine where it's a consistent every year 130 some odd dates a year. And I'm speaking mainly pre-COVID. Obviously, since COVID and now everything is getting back on track, things aren't, I think for most organizations, they aren't back to pre-COVID levels of how they were before. I mean, everybody's still trying to figure it out and work through all the new logistics that have to happen. But pre-COVID, we were, you know, doing 135 dates a year pretty consistently that whole time. There was a time span between 2007 and 2009 where Dwight wasn't working as much, gave me a warning, and then just so happened that Smash Mouth was looking for, you know, a drummer again.
That's right.
So I went back with them for a while. But even during that time, Dwight would call and go, hey, can you do this gig? And I would, you know, do my best to try to, you know, schedule it, you know, like work with Smash Mouth and fly out and do to the Dwight show or whatever.
Is that like usually private gigs?
Yeah, private gigs, or like there was a one-off for an award show in Nashville or something, you know, that type of thing.
Were there any Dwight gigs you couldn't make?
Yeah, there were. There were a couple, and he got Jimmy, his old drummer, and he told me ahead of time, he goes, if you can't do it, you know, don't worry about it. I'll do that.
He knew the deal. I mean, he had told
I mean, he was, you know, he's been great about it. And he just likes to, you know, be fairly consistent with his work and income and realizes that, you know, that we're all in that same position, and he likes to keep his organization the same. He likes working with the same people and knowing what's going to happen and knowing what he can expect from everybody. And so it works out great. I mean, I like that situation, you know. Now, having been into it, the consistency works well for me as a musician,
totally.
as a life. You know, I know some musicians are into the, you know, and I get it. It's exciting to learn, you know, new material, work with a new artist, you know, get all that stuff going on. And for my lifestyle and how I like to live my life, it works really, really well. And we're consistent. We work on the weekends. I get to come home Mondays, you know, today's a Sunday, and I'll play tonight and then fly home and be home Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. Maybe we'll go out Thursday, Friday, or Friday, Saturday, Sunday, something like that. And then I get to be home and have a home life.
Such a great schedule, man.
It is a great schedule. Not perfect for everybody. And, you know, it works well for me and my age and the kind of life I like to live with my girlfriend and our house and all that kind of stuff.
You get to be home. Like I get you to be said, home during the week.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you do other gigs as well during the week, or does it? You try to like kind of just cool it when you're doing the Dwight thing and take the time off.
I mean, again, things have shifted because of COVID, and you know it's interesting. Kind of what happened was that when COVID happened and we shut down, I, as well as most people, I believe, had to sit and think about, like, wow, what's going to come back? Is everything coming back? Is nothing coming back? What will I have? I personally was like, you know, we didn't talk to Dwight or anybody in the band. I mean, everybody's just shut down. It's like, okay, see you in a little bit. And he had a child and got married. And so there was a second where I was like, wow, is it coming back? What am I going to do? And, you know, if he decides to just go into acting and stay home. And you know, I didn't know.
Totally.
Everybody reevaluated.
Because he had a child and you figure, right, you figure.
Who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
Who knows? It could go either way. Fortunately for me, it went in the direction of like wanting to bring his child out to see him play and introduce him to music and his life as a musician and as an artist and blah, 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 blah. So it's great. We're back in. We're back to rolling again. But it did give me a chance to like evaluate things. And I had I'm 60 now, and at the time, so I was, you know, approaching 60 at the time. And it gave me the opportunity to look back and go, I did what I, you know, I checked off the boxes of all the things I wanted to do. And I was, you know, I had a chance to sit and go, if it doesn't come back, I'm pretty stoked as far as what I've done and what I've accomplished. What that means is at the time that happened, how I was living my life was like working with Dwight, filling in my open dates with maybe producing. I was doing some producing up to that point. Some recording dates when they came my way, and it worked it within the schedule, because with Dwight I had a consistent 130 some odd shows a year. Yeah. I had a consistent, he likes to get in the studio fairly often, so it's not easy to like look at my open dates and go, let's just fill them, because I also have to be concerned with like what happens if he fills those dates.
Right.
So if I did fill the dates, I would fill them with production work, because that's easy for me to move if he calls and says, hey, we need to do this, that, and the other. Because he also has an XM radio show.
Mm-hmm.
And he has artists come in, and he interviews them, and then the band plays with the artists. So I'm pretty busy.
Oh, your band?
We play. So he has,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So it's called Bakersfield Beat, channel 349, I believe, maybe 347, but I think it's 349.
So how does that work? You have to show up?
Yeah, we show up. The band shows up.
How often does this happen?
See, that would be the thing, is it could happen, you know, the week before he could call and go, hey, look, Post Malone's coming in.
Next Thursday?
Jason Dylan's coming in. Just like, we get, you know, we're going to do that. So I found myself seeing a lot of my days over the year being filled working with Dwight. So a lot of days would be like, well, I don't need to do music on the days off. I don't need to fill it.
That's why I was asking.
Right. Yeah. And it is different. Like,
you're on retainer, by the way?
No.
Okay.
But, you know,
you have to be open.
The year is...
The deal is you have to be open when...
At the end of the year,
yeah.
When I talk to my accountant and everybody looks at it and goes, wow, what a great year, I don't jeopardize the end of the year, thumbs up, it was a great year, with a quick $500 here,
right.
$200 there, $75 there,
sure.
Whatever comes around.
Sure.
Which, when I first started working with Dwight, I had just moved to LA. So I was playing, I was doing everything. And I was younger and I was single and it was just like, no, every night I'm working, I'm doing whatever, whatever I can be doing, I'm in. And basically, how it came about was like there was a tour with a guitar player named Andy Timmons that I used to play with in Texas. I used to play with him. And then I forgot what year it was. It might have been 2005, 2000, probably around 2005 or 4, where he had an opportunity to tour Europe. And he wanted to know if I wanted to come. And it turned out that it was just some open time that Dwight didn't have booked. So I'm starting my email chain with the management going, look, here are the dates. I'd like to go to Europe with my buddy and do this tour. And they're like, hey, that sounds fine. I'm like, okay, I'll let you know when we're booking our tickets. So then we book the tickets or get it to book. And then I go, I'm going to confirm these tickets. I need to know that it's right. Okay. And they're like, oh yeah, go have a good time, blah, blah, blah. I'm somewhere in Germany and... No, I think maybe it was Spain. I'm somewhere in Spain, and I get this phone call. It's like, where the hell are you? What's going on? And I'm like, oh, shit. So I called Dwight, and he goes, I got a show. What is going on? And I'm like, how did that happen? And I sent him the chain of, you know, the emails that's to his management that said, look, I'm going to be gone. Da, da, da. So I covered my butt, and there wasn't a big problem.
Just to be clear, when he says "Where the hell are you?" is he like at the show or
no?
The show was in a matter of days.
Yeah. The show was like I think it was coming up. You know, there was within because I was over there for a few weeks with Andy. So
that's what I mean. When you send the chain then of emails, your ass is covered. It's like, look.
My ass is covered.
I didn't fuck this up.
Right. My ass is covered.
We cleared this.
But it's still
I mean, he could
awkward.
Be pissed.
Yeah.
And he could be like, damn it. It puts him in a position. But he knows to blame management.
Right. And he knows that I did.
You did your due diligence.
Yes, exactly.
And that they
right.
were the ones who...
Right.
Yeah.
And so it came to the point where I had to reevaluate. I then realized it's like... I just don't take tours. I don't take any other tours.
Right.
And so now I take every, you know, then at that point it was like, okay, take everything local, make sure. And if I did take a tour, because I worked with Andy and he would tour Japan and Europe and stuff. So if I did do that, it'd have to go through him too. I mean, he had to be on that chain, mm-hmm. not just management. Like it just had to be clear. Yes, I'm doing a movie at that time. Don't worry about it. That, you know,
right.
that kind of thing.
Right.
And so as the years have progressed, I found myself taking gigs to fill in the open dates that were easy to move and on a quick call, you know, mm-hmm. if it had to be moved within a week or so. And producing turned out, which I love to do. So producing was something that worked out really well for me. And so I would do that. It would be a lot easier to maneuver around if I had to.
Sure.
And so then COVID hit. And after COVID and we started ramping up and we're working again, I don't feel the same need to fill the schedule with musical projects like I used to feel the need for career, for just staying on top of music and doing that. So I stay on top of music in other ways now, by playing acoustic guitar and learning country songs and singing country songs. And just having fun that way, just strictly with friends that aren't in the business, that are just, they play guitar. My girlfriend plays drums, someone plays bass, and and we're doing it strictly for fun.
You don't want to play out? Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah, no.
You don't want to?
No. No, it's...
No interest?
No interest. No interest.
Not even maybe in the back of your mind, like, well, maybe someday.
Well, the playing out... Okay, so...
Or making a record, I don't know.
During COVID... okay, here's the story. During COVID and during the shutdown, so we were shut down.
Of course, yeah.
The first few weeks in or whatever, I'm like, okay, well, I got drums to repair. Because I think everybody was like, well, what can I do at home? And I'm like, well, I haven't repaired drums in a while. So I got this old Rod. I've got a bunch of Rogers drums. I'm like, I'll repair Rogers drums. I go into a hardware store, the local hardware store, and the very, very nice people at the Ace Hardware store in Orange, California. And I go in and I go to the back where I need to get just a screw for a tension rod casing. And a guy goes, hey, can I help you? And I'm like, well, I kind of know what I want, but sure. I need a screw for this. And he goes, oh, for a tension rod casing. I'm like, how do you know what a tension rod casing is? Well, he pulls up his sleeve and shows me a tattoo of a drum. I'm like, oh my God, how random and funny this is. So we're talking drums and whatever. And he goes, ah, I'm hungover from last night. I'm like, okay. He goes, yeah, I had a gig. I'm like, wait a second. Gigs are shut down. Nothing's going on. How do you have a gig? Like, how is that even possible? And he goes, well, we have this kind of speakeasy where there's a members only jam that these professionals in Orange County that are musicians, but they're successful professionals outside of the industry, have a clubhouse and they have a stage and gear and they, every Saturday night and Friday night, they get together and play. I'm like, that's unbelievable. And
can I come?
That's exactly what I did. So, I mean, and then of course it comes up who I play with and all the other, he says, of course you can come and bring Jill. And so Jill and I go, and we're having a great time, and it's fun, and everybody's playing music. And
did you know anyone?
I know no one. Okay. And it's all just, again, just local people that are professionals, successful professionals outside of the music industry, playing music strictly for fun. They just love it. It's kind of like guys that, if they loved golf, they'd be at a country club, but these people love music. And they have all a bunch of old gear. And like, there's one guy in particular who's very successful who just buys old vintage amps and guitars and stuff like that. So they're, and most of the music they're playing is either punk rock or maybe classic rock. And there was some Latin guys that were doing some Latin stuff. And so they say, hey, you want to come sit in? So I sat in and played a song, and then start talking to the guys that go, well, you should come back and play some more. I said, well, okay, that'd be fun, but Jill plays drums, I play acoustic guitar and sing, and we've always thought about playing country songs. Is anybody interested in that? And so there was a guitar player who said, yeah, I've always wanted to learn country songs, and a bass player said, yeah, I want to do that. So we just started doing that with these guys, and so now we try to rehearse, like maybe on Sundays, like we can't do it today, but next Sunday we'll try to rehearse. And we just kind of learn some new songs or play some of the older songs that we've learned. And then they might have like a birthday party on a Saturday night and they go, hey, we can play, you know, five songs, six songs there or then. So we do get to perform, but it's strictly within the walls of this little, what we call our little speakeasy, our little clubhouse. Their clubhouse that they've invited us to be a part of. And it doesn't go any further than that. And we really, really like it. It's okay. Fun. Yeah. I mean, one person came up and asked Jill's, like, do you have a band name? And we were like, no. And they go, you should come up with a band name. We're like, oh, that'd be fun. So the next day we're driving and Jill goes, California Sage. And I'm like, oh wow, what a cool name. There's got to be a band called California Sage.
Right, that
we look it up and there's no band called California Sage. So we're like, yeah, we'll call ourselves California Sage. So there could be a possibility. We've talked about like progressing on down the line as to maybe writing a song. Like, it's all about just learning. I'm learning how to sing, I play acoustic guitar, Jill's learning drums, they're learning country songs, they're learning, you know, so
covers.
Just straight up covers.
What kind of covers are you doing?
Well, started with Junior Brown.
Yeah.
Do some Dwight songs, some Willie Nelson songs, some Eagles, John Prine, stuff that I've always liked, and just trying to find what I could sing, you know, fairly well or whatever. So it's that type of stuff. And how this all relates to my music career as a professional drummer, who is really the professional drummer for Dwight Yoakam, I kind of in my mind go, all right, getting my paradiddles faster at, you know, adding 5 BPM
right.
on my paradiddles will not do the same benefit for Dwight and my gig as to stepping in his boots for a second and learning songs and hearing what's going on behind me and feeling what's needed.
What feels good for the guy playing the guitar and singing.
Yeah.
And what have we come to? Keep it simple?
Yeah. Well, we've come to keep it simple, but also in the process, it's like learning to hear chord changes like the people that are on harmonic instruments, guitar, bass, or keyboards, or whatever, being able to, you know, really know that's a 1-4-5, there's a 2-5, there's a goes to the 6 minor, there's a go to a 2 minor. Just being able to hear all that stuff and speak it quickly and help maybe a new bass player coming in and go, it's going to go to the 4, you know, because I've written down the charts. And that is more helpful to the gig than necessarily, you know, working on my whatever chops.
A new fill, yeah.
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 Which I did years and years and years and years ago when I went to North Texas, you know, and before then and then after then, you know, tons of hours of practicing. And
you had to.
Yeah. It was, I mean, like at the time, like anybody else, I mean, I shouldn't say anybody else. Like anybody else that wanted to be a professional musician and be for real professional, you worked on all your styles, you worked on your tempo, you worked on your timing. You know, staying with the click track and just all those things that go into wanting to be able to pay your mortgage, your rent, your car payment, your insurance. By playing gigs, and you know, it's like it's not an easy thing to do, and to be successful, you just have to set yourself up to be able to do whatever the phone call asks you to do.
Right.
You know, you just got to be able to say yes, and provide, so they call you again, or that they tell the next person, hey, you should call him because he'll come prepared, he'll come ready, and he can do it. So, you know, and that's just what people want. Obviously, you know. So I still think about that when I'm thinking outside my career as a drummer for Dwight. And at the same time, I've always enjoyed learning music. I've always enjoyed, back then, you didn't have to remind me it was time to practice. You might have to remind me it was time to get the out. Like, hey, right. You got to eat, you got to, you know, do something else, you got to work on your relationship with this other person, life in general. And so the balance for me is learning how to, was learning back in 93 94, I started learning to play bass, and I started playing bass with a guy named Jack Ingram, an artist down here in Texas named Jack Ingram. So that was the first time I stopped playing drums. And I learned a new instrument and got on the learning curve of just going straight up every day. Like everything is new, everything is fresh. I'm learning something new every day. Everything, you know, after 20 some odd years of practicing drums and learning drums, maybe the learning curve was a little more flattened in where it wasn't new and fresh. It was just getting better at something or laser focus into something. And I enjoyed more the curve of just every day, like, wow, so that's how you play the triad of a G, and you walk a G chord, you know, G chord to a C chord.
And you're self-taught, is that?
No. I mean, I would take lessons from, back when I started learning bass, I took lessons from a guy at North Texas named John Adams.
Oh, okay, okay.
And so I would take bass lessons, but not long bass lessons, just enough to, like, mm-hmm. get it, okay, cool, see you in a couple weeks.
Gotcha.
You know, that type of stuff.
Gotcha. And you're practicing every day?
Oh, yes, the right. same kind of right. thing, you know, where I literally stopped playing drums, didn't take any drum gigs, and was working only on bass. And so...
Was that part of the plan, like the idea of maybe I'm going to leave drums behind and become a bass player?
Yes. I didn't know if I was going to leave drums.
I'm sure we covered this, but it's all fresh to me.
Yeah. So, I mean, it wasn't like I didn't have a master plan at that time because I was in my 30s and there was no master plan back then as much as it was like, this is fun. I'm working, I'm making a living doing it.
And was it also part of it? You felt like you could get more work as a bass player?
I think what it was, part of the thing was, is I really liked country music. And I felt like playing, this was in the 90s, so playing the current country music on drums at the time felt like it might be, and this sounds terrible, but it might be a step back where I wouldn't be working at the same level of professionalism. to do the gigs and a step back maybe, and just like I might be bored and I might like overplay and I might just do stupid drummer stuff that didn't make sense. And I really loved playing bass in country music. I just loved the role. I just, because it was, if you were Jaco Pastorius, you would ruin the gig.
Can't do the stupid fills, like you said.
It's impossible for me to overplay.
Right.
That wasn't going to happen.
Right.
For me to just be a solid bass player and work with the drummer and work with the singer, that was going to happen for me.
And then they'd love you.
There was no threat.
Right? Am I right?
Yes.
Like, they're like, you're perfect.
There's no threat for me overplaying the gig. And so... it was great. And funny enough, when I started learning bass, I learned from Dwight Yoakam Records and Beatles Records. And the reason I did that was because knowing how to learn play drums, da da da, I knew that if I would just start with stuff I heard naturally and was just drawn to, that I would catch on quickly, that I would hear it and find it faster than any other way. That was just when I started learning it. And also, I realized with the Dwight Yoakam records that I could hear the bass line as opposed to, like, older records, that his music was based on older records, but you could really hear the bass lines, everything was clear, and you could tell that they were consistent from song to song and style to style. So like you could listen to four records and go, they're doing the same thing. And so what I heard and what later found out was that there were just kind of certain rules that bass lines follow in country music for it to really be successful. And so you would just hear it like, oh, so that's how they walk. When they're just doing the 1-5, 1-5, they're doing that throughout the chord changes. They might, if they stay on, okay, so if it's a chord progression where for it's 1-1, 4-4, 1-5, 1-1. So when it's two chords in a row of the same chord, so you would go 1-5, 1-5. And then it's when you would go to the 5, you wouldn't go, all right, how to explain this well. When you stayed on a chord, you would outline the 1-5, 1-5. If you stayed on the chord just for one measure, you wouldn't go to the 5 of that. You would just stay on its tonic. You wouldn't go to the dominant of that chord. And while that seems maybe minor or like a not a big deal, when you hear it, it makes all the sense in the world. It doesn't, it just, the patterns make sense. So there are patterns that the bass player plays that is consistent from song to song to song. And Dwight's producer, Pete Anderson, for the rhythm section, they followed very consistently the rules. And that's why it was so tight and sounded so good. It was just, it's sort of like, in a certain way, it's similar to me, where I learned African percussion early on out when I was first years of college. And the role of just African percussion would be like, the cowbell plays this pattern and you don't change. And the different drums would play their one. So the one pattern, you're like, well, that's simple. Well, yeah, it is. But when you start playing with everybody else, it becomes a little less simple. And what the simplicity next to that other pattern that's simple allows for the one master drum that's going to solo on top of everything to be the creator and to be the thing that propels while you just plow through that pattern. And I found that to be true in lots of styles of music where, you know, the patterns are important. The consistency of the patterns are important. There will be some flourishing happening, but that's for the other person, you know, that's for someone else. And that's the role of someone else. So when I started learning bass, I learned it with Dwight Yoakam songs and Beatles songs. And how that helped me was that when I auditioned for Dwight, I really knew the songs really well from a deeper level than just the drumming. I understood the bass. And it just so happened he's a huge Beatles fan, which I am too. I love the Beatles. And it just kind of fits. I mean, I spent a lot of years studying Ringo and actually did with Andy Timmons, a Sgt. Pepper's record. We did as a trio, did the whole Sgt. Pepper's record. So the kind of swingy style of Ringo, which I felt like I've adopted and tried to emulate and try to zone in on a lot of times in my playing, fits perfectly for Dwight. You know, just all these years later, when I try out for Dwight, I get the gig, unbeknownst to him, and at the time, a little bit of realization to me, because of all the years I spent listening and studying on a deeper level than just being a drum cover guy back in the 90s, playing his music as a drummer. As a bass player, I just got even deeper into
listening,
the roles of everybody, and not willing to overplay, and understanding not overplaying, and realizing how that is so annoying as a bass player when the drummer drops in the fill that he's been working on for the last 2 weeks in the middle of it. Like, you didn't have to do, you know, come on, man, stop that. Go get another gig if that's what you need to do, because I understand that. I get it.
But not here. Not just, now.
No, please.
Not today, Katie. Yeah.
Go find the Primus cover gig that you're looking for or whatever it is. You know?
That actually leads me to an interesting question I'm interested in is, did it ever get to a point where Dwight had to ask you, can you give me a little more? Like,
it happens in the studio.
Okay.
And it has, where he's like...
Which is, I just want to add, I feel like that's a better place to be rather than the opposite.
So I forgot what song it was, but it was on one of the records we worked on. And I'd like to preface all of this with the great thing about this gig, the Dwight Yoakam gig, is that he uses his band in the studio. Mm-hmm. So out of the few gigs that are consistent legacy type gigs where you're there for 19 years.
Right. Jim Keltner is not in the studio. Exactly. It's not.
Right.
Yeah.
It's Keltner, Freeze.
all the guys, all the boys.
Matt Chamberlain.
Right.
Name the greats. Sure. You know, sure. Just keep going down.
Imagine if Larry London was still around. Yeah, I mean, it's like you'd be like, come on, dude.
Yeah, well, I get it. I mean,
we all get it.
Do understand.
But it's cool that Dwight is like, no, I got my guys.
Yes. So with that being said, to answer your question, we're involved in a song, and he's like, oh, you know, in this section, how about giving me a Keith Moon thing? I'm like, okay. You know, I studied that. I know how to overplay and overfill when you're singing. Like, you know, he does. Yep. I know what he does. Okay.
Better to be asked, though, right?
Oh, yeah.
Than to...
Oh, yeah.
You bring the... Well, easy there, Keith Moon. You know what I mean? Like...
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So it has happened, yeah.
But you can then deliver.
Yes.
And it's like, great, perfect.
Yes.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the place... That's the way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
At least on the gig you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Back to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very specific.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hold on real quick, because you're from Texas.
I was born in a small town in Illinois called Morton, Illinois.
Okay.
A town of about, at the time, of about 10,000. Moved to Texas in 1980. Went to North Texas for 2 years. It was a little over 2 years. And started working with a band called Brave Combo in 83, the beginning of 83, and worked with them till about 92, and that's when I started messing around with bass, played bass, and during that time I had been playing with a guitar player named Andy Timmons, who's
right.
Just one of the best of the best of the best, one of the greatest. And so
you're based out of Dallas at this point?
Denton.
Never
moved from Denton until 2002. So while in Denton, from 94, you know, I started playing with Jack Ingram. 96 to 97, went back to drums with a band called Tripping Daisy. 98 was working with different country artists in Texas. Charlie Robeson was one of them. And then in 99, I got the gig with Smash Mouth. And in 99 and 2000, played with Smash Mouth. Longevity wasn't in the cards with them at the time. And so in 2001, I started kind of coming out to LA and feeling the things around. I hung out with my buddy Mike Malinin, who used to live in Dallas, who was at the time the Goo Goo Dolls drummer, and kind of was starting to feel around LA. He had a closet that was a room in Hollywood that he said, you know, if you need to come out and just hang out, just, you know, grab a sleeping bag and sleep in there. And so I kind of just went there and just kind of felt it out, and I realized I wanted to move to LA in 2002. In April, was ready to make the move, and moved out to LA and started playing with people. And Dwight saw me with a bunch of people, and we jammed a certain night. And then 2003, he needed a band to go on tour and kind of wanted to go away from the large band that he had at the time and wanted just to simplify things with myself, a guitarist named Keith Gaddis, and a great bass player named Dave Rowe, who used to be with Johnny Cash, stand-up. So it was more of a rockabilly, really rock and raw rockabilly sound.
Is that Jerry's dad?
Yeah, it's Jerry's dad.
Yeah.
Have you talked to Jerry yet?
We've messaged each other, we're in touch, but I do everything in person. So he's in Nashville, eventually.
Oh, yeah.
Jerry Rowe, well... I mean, Jerry Reed, man, royalty.
I know. He's royalty. And he's a great drummer, great guy. And I was really fortunate to have met him when he was young, when he was still in his teenage years, and I think still in high school. I don't know. I mean, he was so good even then. I helped him.
But this is in L.A., by the way?
I met him, of course, in Nashville. Dave is out of Nashville.
I was just clarifying. So that was all happened in Nashville. Yeah.
Well... we're the band Dwight and the band is based out of LA. Dave lives in Nashville, but we get to Nashville fairly often. And, you know, Dave, you know, say, hey, my son plays drums and he's really good. And even then he was great. It was like, oh my God, you got to be kidding me. And the kid plays bass too.
Yeah.
It's like, and he really well. Yeah.
He's annoying.
Yeah.
So wait a minute. Was this at the Palomino when you...
No, I missed the Palomino by probably a year or two or a few years.
Okay. So how did you end up jamming with Dwight, like when you were saying?
That was at the King King. And the King King was a pretty established classic place of Hollywood. So I moved to town and I start hanging out with these people that were having this show that they called... Sin City, and every Monday night, I believe it was, they would, once a month, I don't know, they had a residency at Molly Malone's, and it was a bunch of guys playing country music. Some of them, there were a couple guys from Texas, but most of them were ex-rockers. And so another group of people, which included Keith Gaddis, Travis Howard, Waylon Payne, Austin Hanks, basically were wanting to do their own thing. And so we created something and we did our residency on Wednesday nights at the King King. And it was in conjunction with a couple actresses, women actors.
Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah, sorry. I'm not...
No, anyway, we're not that sure. Don't worry about it.
Like, so anyway, and they... wanted, they're from Arkansas and from the South, and they wanted a band to play dance, country dance songs that they and their friends could dance to. So we started doing it at the King King, and because it was, there were actors that were promoting it and that were a part of it, a lot of actors showed up, including Dwight Makes Sense, country, and Lucinda Williams showed up. So we would have guests like Lucinda, like Dwight, would come up and play a song or two with us. And so that's how that happened. And Keith Gaddis and I were playing with a bunch of different people. Like, again, Travis Howard was doing stuff, Waylon Payne. There was kind of a scene at that time that was bubbling in L.A. That was, you know, even like the L.A. Times would write about it, and there was a scene, and we were a part of it, and Dwight's always has his finger on the pulse of what's going on. So he liked Keith and I, but he wanted a stand-up bass player to kind of really go back and be pretty raw. And that's when Keith goes, I know David Rowe, and you know, and David is... There's Kevin Smith and David Rowe when it comes to stand-up bass players. Do you know who Kevin Smith is?
Yes.
And Kevin Smith.
Willie
Smith,
Nelson.
Yes. Kevin Smith spent some time in our... After Dave Rowe left, Kevin Smith came in. So I've been crazy fortunate to have played with two of the best stand-up bass players.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, forget about it. And I say that because I've gotten to sit back during the shutdown and look back and go, wow, man. I mean, that's so awesome. Like, if it doesn't come back, if the music thing doesn't come back, and I just have to, you know, help people find nuts and bolts at Home Depot, I can still look back and go, man, I fucking did it, you know. I mean, I worked hard. I got to play with the greatest, you know. Playing with Dwight, you know, who's arguably going to be one of the greatest legends of country music. How awesome is that? Playing with Andy Timmons and working with Andy Timmons and recording on Andy Timmons records, arguably one of the greatest guitar players ever. I mean, awesome, you know.
Yeah.
He shoots, he scores.
Yeah.
And I say that thinking about, like, you know, growing up in Illinois, in a small town in Illinois, it's... While you see people do it, it's not necessarily, you know, you're like, ooh, how does that work if you're from L.A., if you're from
Doesn't
New
look
York.
Attainable, yeah.
It looks like it's attainable, but, like, you just don't necessarily completely know how. You just know that you better be really good. That's how I looked at it. It was just like, well, I'm not in the middle of LA where it just happens all the time. You and your friends turn out to be Chili Peppers because you're going to Hollywood High together. You know, none of your friends are really going to do it from where I'm from. After high school, it was just like, I better get to an area where people are planning on doing this for real. And that's how I ended up in Denton, because I thought, well, I could go to North Texas and study and learn and work on my craft and work on reading. And I liked jazz music. And so I was like, okay, I'll go there. And it's crazy, crazy intense school. But, you know, that's what I wanted. And if you you either do that, if someone's young and they're listening to it, you either go to a school like North Texas or Berkeley or University of Miami, or you get your butt to Nashville, or you get your butt to New York, or you get your butt to LA, and don't jump into the deep end, you know, and get going, and learn there.
Get your ass kicked. Yeah. You got to jump in. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Do you ever get the itch to come back to Texas? I mean, is it...
No, my life is in L.A.
You feel like now you're
I've been there for 20 years now.
Right, right. It's home now.
Oh, it's definitely home. I bought a condo in Studio City a while back, at the end of 2012. And I just...
Oh, that must have happened after we met, actually. Because I remember you telling me you lived near the Brady Bunch house.
No, that would be my... well, I guess I did live there.
You lived in the same neighborhood.
Yeah, and I bought a condo there, too.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah. I do remember that.
Yeah, so I bought a place there in 2012. And then started dating a woman out of Orange, California, which is down in Orange County. Mm-hmm. And we bought a place together in Anaheim. We bought a house. So we now have a house. So I have a house.
So you got both?
No, I sold the condo to be able to...
Got it. So you're in Anaheim now?
I'm in Anaheim now.
Interesting.
Yes, it is interesting.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that also kind of coincides with where I feel is, it's like, if you know, you're not in LA, so you're not going out all the time.
Yes.
To meet people, to see people, to get the next gig, this, that, and the other. And
it's nice to be able to be in a position to not have to do that.
That's the thing about, again, if anybody's listening and wondering how it's done, you know, the industry towns are LA, Nashville, and New York. And if you don't live there, then you live and die, from what I believe my experience has told me, you live and die by the success of your band. And if you're in a secondary market, whether it's Austin, whether it's Boston, whether it's Chicago, whether it's Seattle, it's a secondary market when it comes to the music industry. And if your band is successful, like Pearl Jam, yay! Mm-hmm. You can, great, everything's wonderful. But if you're one of the hundreds of bands that does pretty well for a second and then breaks up, and then you got to start another band and that goes pretty well for a second, then it breaks up, you're going to hit that ceiling that only Pearl Jam and a few bands break through. You're going to hit that ceiling, and then that's going to be about it.
Yeah.
And at some point when you're 40, 50, or whatever, you probably aren't wanting to start another band with 20-year-olds that want to get in a van, or however it's done nowadays. I don't know how it's done nowadays, because I'm sure people aren't, you know, that there's other ways. When I started with Brave Combos, you got in the van and you just toured.
Yeah.
Because it was possible. Because that was the minor league system to get to the major leagues. You played the clubs and you grew a following. You went to the college radios and you promoted your stuff at the college radios. You went to the independent record stores with your independent labels and you promoted there and you did all that type of stuff until you got a chance to shot at the majors. You know, REM, you know, did it that way, and then they got a shot at the majors. Well, even Dwight, to a certain extent, or Los Lobos, you know, they'd be on Slash or some sort of minor label, and then they'd tour, and if anything hit, you know, they were ready to jump onto Warner Brothers or whatever mm-hmm. it was. So, you know, if you're in the secondary market, this is what happened to me. I had been in Denton up to about my age 40, and I realized I hit the ceiling a number of times, mm-hmm. quite a few. And if I wanted to break the ceiling at that point in my life, I needed to get to a primary market. And L.A. was where I wanted to go. Nashville just wasn't the kind of music that I was really into. I just wasn't into that type of music. I wasn't going to L.A. to seek out the Dwight Yoakam gig. I was just going to L.A. because I liked rock, I liked country, I just liked that kind. I just liked the music
scene. A higher ceiling, I get it.
And New York was just more difficult mm-hmm. as a drummer than I was willing to deal with. Mm-hmm. Quite honestly, I wasn't up for, you know, hauling my drums in a subway or in a cab and, you know, doing all the stuff that working drummers had to do in New York. So L.A. was my choice, and fortunate for me, Dwight, at the time, you know, within a year of me being there, was looking to kind of configure his band and needed all new blood, and I happened to be there at the right time, you know. And those kinds of opportunities happen in L.A., Nashville, New York, that they don't happen necessarily in Dallas, Austin, you know, again, pick a secondary market, or Memphis, mm-hmm. you know. If you're in Memphis, you're not going to get the phone calls that Nashville drummers are getting.
No.
You're just not.
No, you might get the Dale Watson call, but yeah. You're not.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Which is fine, which is great.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
You. I got
but
you.
But if what you would like to eventually get is a Keith Urban call, you better be in Nashville. You better
or
be
in L.A.
Right.
Know a few guys in L.A. who've done some Keith Urban.
Right. And so after spending 20 years in L.A. and having my relationships in L.A. and having my solid relationship with Dwight and my gig, I'm comfortable with moving an hour away and not being in the middle of the universe,
right?
Because my relationship is strong enough that the hour distance isn't really affecting it all that much.
No, I totally get
Everybody's
it.
Cool with, like, they don't have to see me every other night at a club drinking a beer, hanging out, to know that I'm still around.
Right.
And even if I was, I wasn't taking as many gigs anyway, because I was just like, yeah, I want that night off. Or it could conflict with my
right.
Dwight gig.
Back to that, totally.
So the whole moving to, and you know, I could afford a house in Anaheim that's a nice house that allows me to have a drum room, and that just isn't possible in L.A.
Sure, I got it, man.
I mean, at some point, finances are finances, you know, and you just got to go, oh, what can I afford? So when you think about certain drummers, like, I remember when I heard Terry Bozzio left L.A. and came to Austin.
That's right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was like, why would he leave L.A.? You know,
right.
This was years ago, and I'm
why
would he leave L.A.? Why would he? Well, he's done it. He's got every relationship he needs. He doesn't need to be in L.A. He can be as far away as Austin and get on a plane and do whatever has to be done in L.A. that needs to be done in L.A. And this was before, you know, you could do all you need to do in Austin. He probably,
yeah.
I mean, I don't know him, so I've never talked to him, but I'm sure he was like, I've done it. I've got all the relationships. No one's going to not call me because I live in Austin now.
Right.
It might be slightly more of a...
And I think he left now Austin, right? He's not in Austin.
I have no idea.
You and me both. We don't even know our Bozzio, but I got you.
There have to be plenty of drummers,
totally.
Musicians... Whoever.
Billy Cobham moved to Panama, last I heard.
Okay.
Yeah. He's Billy Cobham.
Yeah.
You're still Billy Cobham, wherever you go.
Exactly.
I mean,
so, you know, but they spent that time in New York, L.A., Nashville, whatever.
Totally.
And then the relationships happened. Then their career happened. And it was like, okay, I can, you know, I believe the older you get, I'll just say for myself, the older I've gotten, the more balance in life has been important, where it's not music 110% of the time. And when you're young and, you know, desire and I'm trying to think of the right word, but when it's, you know, it's really important. It, at the time when I was young, it was just really important for me to have a career in music. So that's all I cared about. And there's, and if you're young, that's all you should be caring about when you, you need to have a career in whatever it is.
Yeah.
You better be 110% in and focused, because everybody, there are so many other people that are too, regardless of whether it's in the tech industry or the music industry or whatever industry it is. You know, everybody has got competition, and everybody's struggling to get in there. And it's, from what I can tell, you know, Jill has, you know, young adults trying to make it in the world. It's really hard. Everything's expensive. Rent, or, you know, rent, or like trying to even have the dream of owning a home now as a young 20-year-old out of college is, could seem unattainable, possibly, you know. And so you better be like on it 110%. And I had the desire to do it. So it wasn't like I was thinking, oh, I need to do it to be able to survive this, that, and it was just, I wanted it bad. I just wanted to be a professional drummer. Maybe it was an ego. Well, okay, it was. It was an ego-driven kind of thing.
So what? So what?
You know, it was an ego-driven thing where I just...
It's all ego-driven,
I was,
like you said.
I was so proud to be able to just say, I don't have a day job. Right. I'm working as a drummer.
Right.
And I'm going to keep working as a drummer. And to keep working as a drummer, I got to get better because, you know, here I am having success in Denton, and this guy named Matt Chamberlain walks in to Denton and goes to school for a second, and everybody's like, God dang, have you heard Matt Chamberlain? I'm like, ah, whatever, Matt Chamberlain. And then I go see him, I'm like, holy shit. Okay. Well, okay.
Right. I mean, what can you say?
That's another, I mean, I was like, come on, Jesus.
Okay.
I get
okay.
it. I get it. That's Matt Chamberlain. He's going to be a Matt Chamberlain, and that's awesome. And if I'm going to continue trying to be a Mitch Marine, I gotta at least try to be somewhere near Matt Chamberlain, you know. And I'm not saying I am, I'm just saying you just realize it's like, wow, you know, you're 20 something years old and you think everything's cool, and then, you know, an 18-year-old Matt Chamberlain shows up and you're like, oh my god, it's never gonna stop. That's never gonna stop. There's gonna be the next new person that's just like sick as all get out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so...
Yeah.
I always felt like, you know, I'll find my place.
Yeah.
I'll earn my place, but I'll keep my place. Mm-hmm. You know? I won't take it for granted. I won't just let it go and just do whatever. You know? I'll earn it and keep it. And my place clearly has been, you know, being a drummer, not a drummer's drummer, but a songwriter's drummer.
Yeah.
A singer-songwriter's drummer. And, you know, I worked with Smash Mouth, so, you know, in a pop rock sense, I fit in there, you know, working with Andy Timmons, you know, that guitar virtuoso type music, I fit in there, but I think I fit most with Andy, like when we just did the Beatles record, and I just had to give my best Beatles Ringo, I wouldn't call it an impression, but not impersonation, but just, you know, just, you know, channel him the best I could and work it within the what Andy and the bass player Mike Dane were doing. Just like, how are we doing this as a band? I gotta feel Ringo. I gotta make everybody feel like, you know, I've listened and I've studied and I'm giving all the kudos to Ringo, but at the same time, not so much that there's a Mitch Marine in there as much as there's an Andy Timmons band in there.
Right.
The group sounded like a certain version of the Sgt. Pepper's record. Where, you know, because obviously there's no vocals, so, you know, it's a version of the Sgt. Pepper's record, but everybody brought their, you know, A game of, like, I know Ringo inside and out, and this is how I'm going to approach it, giving all the high fives to Ringo you could possibly give, which, you know, to me, you can never give enough.
No. And I got to bring up one thing, too, that I remember you said that has stuck with me. I have to share with you 10 years ago. I've used the quote to other people, and you said, I like girls. Girls like to dance. I like to play music that makes girls dance.
Yeah. Yeah.
So simple.
Yeah.
And yet, like I said, that one stuck with me.
Right. And it's interesting.
So I had to bring it back.
Well, thank you.
Because I think it makes a lot of sense.
Well, it's interesting because even if you just say, I love what music... Okay, let's just go a little... I'm not going to say deeper, but let's just go in another direction that doesn't bring necessarily sexuality into it. I love how... I saw this on a video the other day. And I see it a lot on... Instagram videos of just how people move to music, regardless of what kind of music it is. And it's interesting because I really focused in on, like, oh, well, I mean, again, it could be just slam dancing. You know, it's like, well, they're reacting to music, and, you know, and you have to be the right drummer to make those guys swing their arms and want to punch each other and dive off the stage and do all that kind of stuff. And, I mean, that's a certain kind of drumming style and a certain kind of drumming skill.
Sure.
That you better... And funny enough, you know, Smash Mouth was very, very ska punk in its roots bass. And I listened to a lot of ska. I listened to a lot of punk. And Brave Combo in the early days played a lot of ska, played polka music really fast, and approached it as a punk band would, which is just crazy, abandoned, fast tempos, and just raw, go for it. And that's, I mean, again, so whether it's a pretty girl dancing a two-step or... an older grandpa in overalls doing a clog step, or young kids slam dancing. The pulse of music and the connection of music to another human and makes them move and makes them do whatever. I mean, it's just awesome. It's a great place to be for a drummer, and I just hope that drummers get to feel that. I mean, one thing about work. You know, my girlfriend Jill, she started playing drums after we met. She sat down on the drums. She goes, I took her to my studio, and I'm like, yeah, and I showed her my drums, played a little drums. She goes, oh, that's so cool. She didn't know I was a drummer when she met me. So anyway, so she's like, oh man, I think I'd like to learn how to play drums. I said, well, I'll help you, but just so you know, right now when you hear music, you just move and you feel it and you just get lost in the music. If you start learning drums, you'll never hear music the same way. You're going to be listening completely differently. It's not bad,
right. But
you'll never be free just to, like, get lost in the music and just sway around. She goes, okay, I'm willing to take that. Okay, So now, when she listens to music, she's listening to drum fills, she's listening to drummers, and she's really hearing things like drummers or musicians listen to music now. And she's happy, she likes it, and she loves talking about it, and she loves talking to other musicians about it, and it's interesting for her. But it's been fun watching, again, somebody get into drums and go through the steps that I went through many years ago. And you know, first she's starting to play and she's playing along with records and has headphones on. And I said, well, that's fun, but it's even more fun when you play with somebody else. Right, when there's right. another human being, you have to interact with them. She goes, well, I don't know how we would do that. Well, her kids were in School of Rock, and it just so happened that the School of Rock down in Orange needed, they had their programs and their studios booked up till 9 o'clock when kids, you know, it was like kids, bye-bye. And so they wanted to keep the studios open till 11, so they started offering it to adults. And they called her and they said, well, do you want to play drums? We're going to start having an adult School of Rock band. She goes, ah. I'm like, God, yes, yes, you got to do this. So that was her first chance to start playing with other people. So it's fun to watch, like, all of a sudden she's playing with other people. And there's like, that's connection. So now playing in front of other people, playing with those people, working on the songs and playing in front of other people. Now that's the next thing. And then the next thing is when you are playing in front of people and they start moving. When you start, yeah. I mean, it's an interesting thing, and it doesn't happen for, it's hard for adults, you know, later in life to start something that's fairly difficult and easy to let go of, you know, like, oh shit, I don't, why would I work?
This is too hard.
Yeah, why would I work this hard on something? You know, I gotta practice.
I'm never gonna make a living. Why
am I doing this?
And
brings me back to why I'm playing acoustic guitar and stuff is because it's fun. It's fun to learn. It's fun to discover new stuff. It's fun to stretch out. It's fun to put yourself in an uncomfortable position and have to work through it, you know? Yeah. And, yeah, that type of thing.
Listen, man, I unfortunately have to wrap it up, but I appreciate you giving your time.
Well,
for part two. Years in the making.
I know.
Hunt Sales did the same thing. Like he was first season, 10 years, and now Mitch Murray.
Yeah, and he's down here now. I follow him on Instagram.
Yeah, he's been here a while.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you interviewed him in L.A., I guess, the first time?
The first time I was out here on tour, and we had worked it out ahead of time.
He been down here in Austin that long?
Yeah, because it was 10 years ago. Both interviews with him were done in here in Austin, Texas. So
yeah.
Yeah. Dun, 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 yeah, man. Dun, 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 I mean, legend. Legend.
I mean, like, if that isn't in your drummer vocabulary, man, you're missing out.
And also just that great feel of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I mean, you can't overlook it. It just feels good, man. It feels so good.
That's the best.
And it's like both sides of that spectrum. One's easy going, and then the other one, man.
And the sound?
The sound. No, man, there's only one Hunt Sales.
Yeah.
There's no one who plays like Hunt Sales. That's the other thing.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Yeah.
He's a Hunt Sales type. No. Doesn't exist.
Yeah.
So, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, no, it's way cool.
Yeah.
You have a good gig. You get to talk to all these cool people.
It's not bad.
And I remember, I'll just say this. When we first met, mm-hmm. you were saying, I have this podcast. And I'm like, iPod? I mean,
man.
And so I'm coming late, way late to the game. You're way early in on the game. So, I mean,
a lot of people didn't know what it was. Don't feel bad.
Okay.
When I started, I had to explain it to a bunch. Oh, trust me. Guys were like, what? Where does this air? Like, they just didn't get it.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you have a camera?
No.
Yeah, they didn't
get
it at all.
No camera? I was like, okay.
Podcast?
Yeah.
And I would say, go listen to this one. You'll get an idea. And then be like, I don't even know how to find it.
What podcast are you a fan of? What do you...
I've said this before. What I did was WTF with Marc Maron.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, he was still doing just comedians. Mm-hmm. It was before he branched out to mm-hmm. just, you know, have a president on and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. He just had comedians. And I was like really into Drumhead magazine.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this is a great one. Mover did
it. Who was your first one? Was Mover your first person?
No, the first person was Brian Tichy.
Brian Tichy, and then but I had a bunch of people lined up at once. It was like Kurt Buscara and Jimmy Paxson, and you know, a bunch
of, you were in LA,
just a bunch of guys. No, I was in New York.
Oh,
I'm from New York. It was started in New York.
Oh,
but I was in LA a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was both.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I said this would be the Marc Maron thing. I said this would be a cool format for drummers.
Yeah.
And again, taking what Mover did with Drumhead Magazine, right. I was like, and combine it.
Did you?
That's how I got the idea. That's it. That was it.
Was there any thought of like, this is going to be huge? I see this as being huge.
No.
Strictly, I love it. This is going
to
be fun.
I want this show to exist. And I waited a year.
You were doing it almost as a selfish.
Well, like, I waited a year because I'll tell you that too. The idea that I thought like Mover with Drumhead, I went, yeah, but he's Mover. It's like back to your idea of moving into Anaheim and saying, or Billy Cobham's in Panama. Yeah, but or Bozio. He was Bozio. Mm-hmm. So I said, he was Mover. I'm not a guy. You got to be, we need a guy. So okay. I thought about that for a while. Mm-hmm. Like maybe I'd produce and get someone. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? But then I figured they'd be like, what do I need you for?
Right.
So I just finally just went, I'll just do it myself.
Right.
You know, and that's it. That's it. But I had no idea that you could even make one nickel.
Right.
Because it was just for the love of the game.
Right.
Back to like.
Right.
I just want this show to exist, kind of.
Right.
Thing. I want to hear this.
Yeah, stuff. Exactly.
It's like, this is what I'd want to listen to.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
It's back to that. And like music, when guys say, this is the music I want to hear.
Who was your...
Go ahead.
Like, your top three gets? Like when you were like, oh my God, I cannot believe this is going to happen.
Well, Hal Blaine.
Yes.
Oh, my God. That was, I mean, just, you know.
Oh, my God.
Oh, there's been a...
Where was Hal at? Did you meet him
Palm,
at his house?
Wait, Palm Desert Springs? Palm Desert, I forget, because I get confused with it. Not Palm Springs, but...
Palm Desert.
Palm Desert.
Uh-huh. Does he live out there, or did he live out there?
Yeah, his house.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah. Well, I got some cold beverages, if you...
Were there some drums, or were there some Hal Blaine drums?
No, drums. No drums around.
Okay.
No, he had all these signs out front, like beware of dog and all this kind of dog, beware of the dog and this and that and fake barking, and there was no dog in the house. I love that.
That's
loved
awesome.
It. Yeah. Yeah.
Where was he in his career? How old was he at the time?
Oh, no. He was retired.
So
no, he was an old guy. Yeah, no.
And he was like, loved my life, had a great life. I'm doing other things.
Oh, yeah. Made millions, lost it, you know, that kind of
right,
thing.
Right, I remember
the divorce, the whole thing. Had mm-hmm. a Rolls Royce once, had a boat, this. Mm-hmm. Don't have any of it anymore, mm-hmm. but, like, super content.
Yeah.
No bitterness.
Yeah.
No, nothing.
It's just really...
a good dude, you know? Like, wow, we should all aspire to end up like that.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing getting older, you know, and aging, and especially in the music industry, and you know, it certainly helps attaining your dreams. It really does. Obviously, it really does. Because when the shutdown happened, I really felt sorry for anybody that was 24, 25, and just starting to get some shit going. I really felt sorry for those people.
I feel sorry for all the kids.
Yeah. Well, it was a weird thing, man. Some people, you know, really were ready. They didn't know it, but were ready for shutdown. They already had their studios in place.
Right. That issue.
I mean, it went both ways for a lot of people, for everybody. You know, it was either like devastating for your thing, or you're like, I didn't know that I was in such a good position to like parlay this time. You know, I'm ready. And, you know, so it's interesting, but it's interesting to hear. At my age, 60, hearing somebody that was older, that, you know, left music behind, doing other things, super happy and content, because for the longest time in my life, I was just like, this plane can't go down because I haven't done this, I haven't done that, I haven't done this.
Totally.
You know, and you know, as you get older, you do start going, okay, well, you know, I guess I don't have to do this, don't have to do that. And it's a lot easier when you're like, well, I don't have to do it again.
Right.
It's a lot. So who's another one besides Hal Blaine?
Ooh, I can't. Keltner was cool, but that was a phoner. But I mean,
oh, I don't want to, you know.
Yeah, you'd be leaving out a lot of people. But Hal Blaine and Kelton are definitely...
Not bad. I tried hard for Jim Gordon. People don't know that story. I have to tell them. I really tried hard to deal with the prison, and I got through, but that's a whole story I should tell another time. But
you
I did try to get in to see Jim Gordon.
Yeah, boy.
Which would have been interesting, a guy in a jumpsuit. But hey, man, you know?
Well, here's the thing. It's like I even have a playlist on my Spotify of Jim Gordon.
Because Jim Gordon.
You have to.
Yeah.
You have to.
We don't really obsess about what he did.
You have to. And it's interesting because I didn't realize until I went down that rabbit hole, I had no idea how much of an influence he was. And I had no idea who the hell he was.
Right.
But I'm like, wow, I didn't know I go to the Bell because of him and do the Bell stuff there. And I didn't, I mean, just naturally, just instinctually, I just was like, oh my God, there are so many things that are part of me that I just didn't know was him. I mean, it's easy to nail Ringo and go, I'm a part of, because, ooh, I need your love. I mean, it's easy.
Sure.
Got it. Done. That's why I'm into Ringo. That's why I do this. That's why I do that.
Yeah.
And then, oh my God, I didn't know I did that because of that Sonny and Cher song or because of that. It's crazy. And then to like put it in a playlist, I recommend it for everybody. You go down it's easy to do. You just type in Jim Gordon. A lot of people have written all the stuff of all the tracks he's on that are easy to find and easy to put a playlist of Jim Gordon. And then just, you know, there's hundreds of songs. And even if someone got it wrong and it's not, well, it's maybe Hal Blaine or Keltner.
There's a guy I had on the show, producer, engineer guy, he swore it's Jim Gordon on, I think he may have said it was Ringo on You're So Vain, but the other people say it's Jim Gordon. You get a lot of that sometimes. You get guys who literally say, I was there.
Right.
And you're still like, I don't know about that.
Yeah.
Like Bernard Purdy.
Right.
I played on beat, and people are like, I don't know. So, you know.
Right.
Back those, we don't know who did what.
But you're not like wasting time.
You're not
checking
wasting
it
time.
Out.
You're not wasting
and
time.
And even if you go down the rabbit hole of who, that's even better because now you're really getting deep into the.
Totally.
The weeds of like, well, why would it be him and why would it not be him?
Yeah, it feels like Gordon, but who knows?
Yeah.
We don't know.
Yeah.
We don't know.
And if you get to listen to some of the live Jim Gordon stuff, you know, I mean, it's just like, God dang. It's just so great.
Cocker.
I mean, you know, listening to that. Another thing that's interesting, Jill and I would find different reasons to go down a rabbit hole. We went down a rabbit hole of drummers that sing. Mm-hmm. And why they sound different and how they approach
Levon.
Well, yeah, you start
Doyle Bramhall.
You start there. And Henley, you know, I mean you just start there and we went through a bunch of them, and then I was like, here's one that you probably wouldn't be thinking of, and she's not like real familiar with Frank Zappa, but Terry Bozzio.
Right. Good point. You Terry don't think of it, you're right.
As the devil. I recommend everybody get on the YouTube machine and check out Terry Bozzio singing with Frank Zappa.
Titties and beer.
Fucking great.
Yeah.
It's great. And the guy is still killing it. Dean Castronova.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
I just played it the other day for our bass player who had no idea that Dean was singing, you know.
That's right. And Bissonette, by the way, on the Ringo tour.
Oh, is he sing?
Well, he does like background.
Right,
he's
sure.
Like, you know, I saw them with, what's his name, doing 10cc. Like, I'm not in love. He's doing, and that's Bissonette with Lukather and Colin Hay and Greg Raleigh. Not bad.
Yeah, Abe with McCartney.
Being able to do backup.
Well, yeah. And then, but the lead singer while playing drums means...
The Romantics, that guy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that was the big
Blondie.
Hit. Oh, Clem Burke.
I think Clem sing?
No. It was What I Like About You.
Right.
That's sung by the drummer.
Right.
You know?
And then... The metal band with the red leather pants.
Ooh, you got me. They were singing drummer. Metal band.
Pop metal. Oh, God. I feel like an idiot.
I know a listener right now is screaming at us.
Oh, no.
All right.
No. Well, come on. Red leather pants.
All right. It'll come back. Red leather pants. He's going to the phone, folks. He's going to the phone. The phone knows the answer.
Red leather pants, metal. Red leather pants.
Wait, singing? Is he the singer or just one of the singers?
And he sets up sideways.
Right. Oh, Striper?
No.
Sideways.
He's because he's on the side because he sings. Oh, come on, get up here! Oh, come on!
I'm stumped because I can picture sort of a sideways thing.
Lover Boy.
Wait. Also, you know what? Are you thinking of Sister Christian? That Night Ranger.
Night Ranger.
Sister Christian. That's the singing drummer.
Night Ranger.
Yes.
Night Ranger.
That's what it was. I know what you mean now. Sister Christian. Big hit.
Oh yeah,
sung by the drummer.
Yeah. And so it's a whole nother interesting rabbit hole to go down when you're just, I don't know. Well, it's so funny easy to be drummer geek, man. It's just so easy.
I love it. Unfortunately, I got to cut this. Otherwise, I could spend. Listen, we got to do this again before you're 70.
Okay.
Please.
Oh, whatever.
Please.
Yeah.
Like before, we don't have to make it every 10 years.
Okay.
Let's do this again.
Okay.
Because I think there's a lot more.
Well, thank you very much for including me in all this stuff, because I feel honored to be just even involved in any of this kind of stuff.
And, bro, you got a lot to say.
Well, I appreciate it.
You're sharing knowledge. I mean...
Well, it's fun. It's a good time. And congratulations on all your success for this, because...
Thank you.
As now a big fan of podcasts, I listen to them all the time. And I listened to yours, and I hadn't listened to it in a while. I did look it up a while back. I remember going, oh, I remember that. And so I've been listening to a few, and it's great, man.
Cool,
it's fun, and you do a great job at it.
Thank you, Mitch. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
All right, thanks, Dave.